CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 56, with Lisa Fulner, a role model for leadership and life lessons in ophthalmology. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today I have a very special guest, Dr. Lisa Fulner, MD and PhD, with an incredible path in ophthalmology and how she kind of carved out her own way of doing things. You know the name because she's the chief medical editor of Ophthalmology Management, and she has a big, important interest in your future and what you can do to manage your existing practice better, grow your practice, and kind of be your own boss, which is the best thing ever. So Lisa, welcome to our podcast. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Uday. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be here with you today. And, you know, among all the people that you've interviewed, I really feel honored and privileged to be here. So thank you.
Oh, for sure. I just love your story, your path. I mean, you're obviously brilliant. You're in the MSTP program, which for those who don't know is Medical Scientist Training Program, where you basically get a full ride for an MD and a PhD. So you obviously have both those interests in research as well as obviously clinical stuff. How'd you get into that?
So when I started college, the chairman of the biochemistry department at the school where I went, Case Western Reserve University, was my family's best friend. And I knew I wanted to go to med school since I was 12 years old. My path was always to study the brain. And it goes back to early in my life when I used to watch Nova on PBS, where they were doing research on memory. And I had a science teacher in my elementary school who really turned me on to studying the human body. So I always knew since I was in sixth grade, this is what I was going to do.
Sure.
And when I went to college, I really hated all of my biology classes because they were too kind of large, you know, generalized subjects. Mm-hmm. And I really like a lot of detail, and I need to know and understand the very core and essence of things. And this family friend was the head of the biochemistry department. So I switched my major to biochemistry, and I got involved in research as a freshman.
Wow.
And did a research project through all my 4 years. Did an undergraduate honors thesis in biochemistry, and he was one of the pioneers in molecular biology. So starting way back, and I won't tell you what year that was, I started in the beginning of molecular biology and did a lot of research and really loved it. So I took a year off to find out whether or not I wanted to do this as part of my life, and I did it full time at Temple University School of Medicine and realized I loved it. And applied to a bunch of MD PhD programs and ended up at University of Rochester School of Medicine. At the time, they had one of the top neuroscience programs in the country. And I wanted to do research in neuroscience and ended up being the only molecular biologist except for one professor there in the whole department. And that sort of got me, you know, into doing my MD and my PhD through Rochester.
Wow. Yeah. Back in the day, I mean, it was unusual to do molecular biology. Now it's so commonplace. Things have changed so much.
Yeah. There's a kit for everything now. We had to do it by scratch. I actually did some, you know, early day sequencing before we had PCR and machines to do it, and did it all on my own, and actually have some of my sequencing in GenBank. So that's
pretty
long time ago.
Certainly molecular biology has changed the same way. Yeah. Like any specialty, like ophthalmology, cataract surgery 40 years ago, 30 years ago, compared to today, is like night and day.
Yeah.
The same with molecular biology. But then you didn't choose to do a full-on research route, and that you are far more interested in surgery and hands-on.
So, you know, I always thought I was going to be in academic medicine. You know, I thought I was going to set the world on fire and be this famous academic physician, do research, teach residents, you know, see patients in the clinic. And when I got to residency, I saw a different world for female academic physicians. They were very happy. There were too many hats to be worn as a wife, a mother, you know, a teacher. And it was at a time when universities were no longer supporting grants for research clinicians, where you had to apply for your own grants. And base salaries for academic physicians had sort of dropped out, and you had to support your own salary with your clinic earnings. So a lot of academic physicians, especially women, found it difficult to successfully fulfill all of those roles, apply for grants, see enough patients, teach residents, be a mom. And I got pregnant when I was an intern because, you know, when I entered residency, I was 32. It took me 9 years to do an MD PhD because I did a basic science PhD, not a clinical PhD at the NIH. So, you know, it took me longer because I was really actually doing bench science. And at 32, I got pregnant as an intern, had my first child, first month of residency.
Wow.
So that was a challenge. And when I looked at the women around me, I thought, you know, they are not happy. And they were leaving academics kind of in droves in the department where I was. And I thought, you know what, I can't be the best at everything. There's too many hats to be worn. And I chose my family first. You know, I wanted to do a fellowship. You know, I was in Minnesota and Minneapolis. I trained with the top cornea people at the time with Jay Kratchmer, Don Doofman, Ed Holland was there, Dick Lindstrom, Dave Harden. You know, I had exposure and I really had a great passion for cornea and anterior segment. But at 36, when I finished, 35, 36, going on to do a fellowship, wanting more children, it was just, you know, it wasn't the right time for me or my family to just continue my education. And so I decided that I was going to go into private practice and hoped to, you know, do some clinical research later on. So I love surgery. I love all the hands-on. But over the years, I've been involved with a lot of startup companies. I've done a lot of preclinical research and, you know, early adopting, you know, adopter research. Providing, and I still do. I do a ton with some surgical and pharmaceutical companies. So I've kept my hands in it, and I do do a lot of mentorship. So I feel like I'm still doing a little teaching, just a different path.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, you make it what you will. So instead of sitting there in front and doing bench research, you're still involved in research, but now more clinical trials, or more working with industry to develop new products. And then you still get to teach and mentor. I mean, I learn from you from the podium all the time. So you're still obviously a teaching.
And you know, I do work with clinical trials. I've been a medical monitor on some clinical trials. And I really feel like that's where my value is because I can really design really good studies and help companies see ahead of time where their studies are, you know, not well designed and that they're not going to get the result they're looking for because they have too many variables or their data is not clean. And that experience has really helped me fulfill that role.
That's fantastic. Plus some of the mentors you mentioned, these huge names, Ed Holland and Dick Lindstrom and Dave Harden, all also left academics.
Yes.
So it's,
I feel so fortunate to have studied under those, you know, I call them my heroes, brilliant anterior segment cornea surgeons.
Yeah, no, absolutely great point there. And for anyone who's listening, you can always change gears in life. Nothing's set in stone. So you can do something for a while, decide, you know what, it's time to change gears, do something a little different. That's perfect.
I think, you know, life is just a bunch of forks in the road and you have to just, at each time when you're presented with one, choose the one that feels right at the time. And sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong, but it doesn't mean that that's the only path. There's so many, as you said, there's so many choices.
Yeah, for sure. I'm also very proud of you that your practice is not only, of course, the full spectrum of ophthalmology, including a lot of cataract surgery, but also you brought in, you're doing the aesthetics as well. So yes. I love that artistic sense you must have.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because I come from a very long history, a family history of artists. My father was an architect. My brother is an artist. My cousins are all artists. My other cousin in L.A. is a docent for LACMA and the Getty Museum. My son is a tremendous artist. So there is a little bit of artist in my life. But really, I developed the aesthetic division as a way of making money when I opened my practice in the beginning. So when I got out of residency, I joined one of the most prominent practices in Baltimore. Very huge, very large, tons of volume, did an incredible amount of surgery right out of the gate. but I felt disconnected from my patients. They were just, you know, just revolving door. And I really became a little disillusioned with the experience and wanted to get to know people a little better. So I left and went to a small practice, which was diametrically opposed to that experience. And then went out on my own with the support of my husband. And, you know, when you're first starting out by yourself, money is always an issue, right? How do I get money in? And at the time we were in paper and you filed paper claims, it took 90 days to get paid. And my very dear friend, colleague and mentor, Sherry Rowan, who was also in Baltimore at the time, who's one of my dearest friends, said, you know what, you got to do some aesthetics because that's cash. So you get the cash in while you're waiting. Right. And so very early, when aesthetics wasn't very popular in ophthalmology, I started doing skincare, and then I did Botox, and then fillers got, you know, more common, different kinds of fillers. And then it kind of exploded from there until I have a full aesthetics division where we do, you know, toxins, fillers, laser, hair removal, body sculpting. We do pretty much everything. And so it's kind of grown its own legs at this point.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, it's nice to have that talent. I have two sisters who are plastic surgeons, and they've always been super artistic and obviously brilliant. I was just always some math geek. So for me, like, I'd much rather look at astigmatism than look at aesthetics.
So yeah, you know, I think luckily I have a little bit of my dad who was very right and left brain. I mean, my son is exactly my father. So he's just as strong with math and science as art. Sure. I have a lot of math and science and a little bit of art.
Well, it's a little bit of it. You're obviously running a very successful practice, but what I like is you're bringing that knowledge of things you learned along the way to all of us in your role at Ophthalmology Management. Tell us about that.
So I was shocked and amazed when Doug Perry asked me to be chief medical editor. You know, it's such an honor because when I started my own practice, I had zero business experience or knowledge. Right. I knew absolutely nothing.
That's all of us. We're not taught that residency.
Right. And I really didn't have many mentors in the business world to help me. So I was kind of shooting from the hip all the time. And at the time, Ophthalmology Management was my Bible of business. I constantly was like dog-earing and ripping out pages and kind of learning from the experts who were publishing in Ophthalmology Management. And so I've always loved it and depended on it. And I think it's such a great resource for knowledge about how understanding A, the language of business and what you need to know, what you need to do, how to create efficiencies, how to maintain staff, the advice of some of the greatest experts. And to be asked to be chief medical editor, it was sort of like a full circle for me because it really was, you know, this paper mentor that I had. And I just feel really honored to be in a position where I can take it to the next level. And take it back to its roots. And I've really been pushing to put ophthalmology management again in the forefront of where people turn for practice management advice, and really relying on not just giving infomercials, but giving people what they need to know. Yes, I want to do advanced technology lenses, but what does that mean? How does that change the office flow? What knowledge do I need to give my staff? How do I need to talk to my patients in a very concise time? How to create those efficiencies, do correct billing, and things that make taking on that next adventure in your practice not a burden, but an adventure that you figure out how to make it efficient and profitable. And you know, during my growth in my practice, I always wanted to be on the cutting edge, never wanted to be, you know, following what the curve was. Or I used to say, I don't want to be a dusty book on the shelf and do the same thing every single day. I always want to have something new. So much to the dismay of my staff, every 6 months I would introduce something new. And 6 months is about the time that you need to kind of figure out how to train your staff. What do you need to do? Do you need to make space? Do you need to build space? Like all the things in introducing something new to your practice. And so, you know, I really wanted to go back to ophthalmology management and help other people keep that passion for growth in a way that they felt I have the answers so that they don't lose efficiency, they don't lose money for billing, they don't lose staff, and to just, you know, partake in spreading that knowledge to help people grow and have some place to go for advice. And I think, you know, that there's a transition recently between Pentavision and Broadcast Med, and anytime there's a transition, there's kind of a lag period, but I've had the opportunity to talk to the new head of the ophthalmology and optometry division of Pentavision / Broadcast Med, and they have some great, great things planned that are very much in the, you know, the same philosophy of growth and introducing new things and keeping ophthalmology management moving into the future, relying more on digital communication, not leaving paper behind, but really getting into the more digital and podcasts and videos and webinars and giving another direction for information to be given out to readers or listeners. So that's just an exciting place to be with ophthalmology management. So I'm super excited.
Yeah, it's a really a unique journal in that it's the one that really has probably the most useful articles regarding management of your practice and all the little things you mentioned about dealing with employees or integrating new technology or educating patients or all these things, in addition to clinical things of here's a surgical technique, here are new products, here's whatever. Now, let me ask you about being, and you're obviously an early adopter as opposed to a late adopter. How important is it for a younger ophthalmologist who's listening to this podcast, let's say under age 50, to become an early adopter? Is that important?
So I think that, you know, I think we need to live without fear. And we need, you know, for ophthalmologists, we're used to being, you know, the biggest and the brightest, and we are very bright, smart people. There's not a single ophthalmologist who got where they are because they weren't super smart.
Of course.
But it comes with that feeling of perfection. And so sometimes perfection is a barrier to trying something new. And if something frightens you, that's the thing you should do first. That's the thing you have to overcome. You cannot live in fear of not being great at something. You have to be not great at something to become great.
Put yourself out there.
Young ophthalmologists, you know, I had a professor who, he always messed with me in the OR when I was like a third or fourth year resident. So every single time I got comfortable, he would make me sit in a different position. He would take the instrument away. He would give me a new instrument. He would mess with whatever I was doing so that I never got comfortable. And he told me, and I think about him all the time, he said, you have to have more than one way of doing things. You can never get comfortable because you don't know what's coming at you in any given case on any given day. And you have to have a lot of different ways and be comfortable changing the way you do things so that you can adapt and manage. And it was the single most important thing I ever learned. And I think that being uncomfortable is what drives us forward and makes us better. And it's really funny because I watch your cataract coach videos sometimes in the hallway outside the OR when I have to go in and do something I haven't done before. You know, I'll be like, okay, you know, and I'll watch it over and over again. I'm like, okay, got it. And, you know, I'm literally going in to do something that I haven't done before. And you just have to know that, you know, you got here because you're talented and you're bright and you're capable of anything. You just can't be afraid of it. And I think that's where young ophthalmologists need to remember that you know, you're not always going to be the best and that you're going to start out at not best and you're going to get there.
Mm-hmm. I also like your point that don't be complacent. Don't grow stale. Don't do the same thing over and over again. Don't fail to evolve. Our field is constantly evolving, right?
That's what I love about it.
Right. I mean, things are always happening. So you've got to have to stay at that cutting edge. And, you know, you think back to when I did my training. I mean, so many things didn't exist. There was no OCT machine, no anti-VEGF, no lamellar corneal transplantation, no EDOF lenses, no femtosecond lasers. They didn't exist.
We had one of the very first phaco machines. It was a Storrs, and it was in a box like this big, okay? Right. And it had like dials that you turned. And when I tell this guy messed with me, he would like turn the dials, you know, I mean, It was just, yeah. I mean, we didn't, and the visual field machines, I don't even, they, we didn't, we had like one of the first Humphrey Field, where you still were doing those ones where you had like the felt board. I don't remember even what they were called.
Oh, the Goldmont Field of the felt board. You know what they're doing now? Now there's phone-based visual field things. You can put it on your face.
Yeah, you know, that's, you know, my daughter just finished med school, and the volume of information and the volume of technology that new ophthalmologists and new you know, medical grads need to know just vastly outweighs what we had to learn and know. So now we learn like, oh, we're learning a new thing. We're learning a new thing. They're learning all of these new things. And,
right.
you know, no matter what, they should still know how to do an extra cap. I don't know how many of them know how to do an extra cap. I don't even know if I remember how to do an extra cap, but knowing that videos. It's somewhere in the vault, you know, it's somewhere in there. If I'm, you know, faced with having to do it, I can still do it. They have so much more to learn all at once. That's incredible.
Yeah, that's the big challenge. I remember looking back long ago when I was in med school, and I was talking to my parents, who were both MDs, and they went to med school like just when Watson and Crick discovered DNA. And then here I am, like my major in college was like you know, molecular genetics and this kind of stuff. Like that's all I did. But now looking now decades later, what I learned was that in college was or med school, a drop in the bucket. It's nothing compared to what the kids do now.
They have so much, but you know, they have the benefit of, you know, when we wanted to look something up, you went to the library and you found right. that book on a shelf somewhere. They're just like on their phone, on their iPads, you know, they're on it's whatever. And that piece of information is quickly in their hands. And so that's the, you know, what I've watched my daughter and her friends acquire information at a rate that we couldn't even imagine back then. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's really cool.
We were both just in Tampa at the Tellingit meeting with Osher. And I remember as a resident getting those VHS tapes of Osher's videos and watching them and learning from that. And then now you're right. If you want to learn how to do a modern day proper extracap, which we call M6, manual small incision cataract surgery, you get a video on your phone in HD anywhere on the planet and you can learn how to do it.
I still have my very first. So back in the day, the nurses would record your first cases. And I have mine on two or three VHS tapes of my early cases. I don't have anything to play them on, but I have them.
Right. I mean, now in your house, you'll be hard-pressed to even find a DVD player, let alone a right. VHS player.
Exactly.
But yeah, that's the neat thing. You're right. The new generation has so, so much more to learn. And I think we have realized in our careers that, yeah, your residency and fellowship training at best is just a good foundation to keep you learning for the entirety of your career.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the way we have learn information now is so wonderful because there's different kinds of learners. You know, you can be visual, auditory, hands-on, and all those things are available now, which is just incredible. You know, the advent of AI and, you know, virtual ophthalmology mm-hmm. where you can actually now go in that virtually into an operating room and feel like you're sitting with the surgeon and watching what they're doing is just incredible. Eric Rosenberg, you know, he does a lot of that virtual stuff and it's incredible. I mean, there's a way to learn for everyone. It's just not one dimensional anymore. And I find it a little overwhelming because it takes me a while just to learn how to use the technology. But, you know, I think the young people, they're incredible. I mean, you know, you've heard these people speak and you've seen them on the podium. They're just the rate at which they learn information is just is amazing and fantastic.
Yeah, you're right. It's a different world, you know, even different skill set. I've found that like, you know, in the last, let's say decade or so, you had a generation of residents growing up playing video games. So they're already used to looking there, straight ahead, in their hand, using both hands together on a controller, which they never look at their hands. So that's basically surgery. Like you look into the microscope and you don't look at your hands. And it's like they come with a high level of dexterity and hand-eye coordination already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of young ophthalmologists ask me, I go to a lot of meetings, and young ophthalmologists say, is it still okay? Is it too late in the U.S. here to start a private practice? Can we start from scratch? Can a young ophthalmologist today start from scratch, hang a shingle, if you will? What do you think?
So I think that it is. I don't think it's easy, you know, in this world of big practices and PE, but I think it's possible. And I think if you do it smart. So when I opened my practice, there was two huge practices in town. Okay. And now there's three huge practices and me. And I think what I did was smart. I shared a space with four optometrists that had their own group.
Okay.
And they also had practices outside of the office that I was in with them. And we grew our practice together. They were each there one day a week, and I was there five. And I did all of their medical and surgical eye care. I referred them all of my vision and optical. We shared expenses, and we grew together. And wow, that allowed me to really build a practice quickly and have a low expense on that. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I bought their practice. You know, right. So I doubled the size of my practice a few short years later. But, you know, thinking out of the box about how you can, you know, get a step into a community that may feel like it's already very crowded is just, you have to think out of the box. You know, people would have said, are you crazy? You're never going to be able to compete with them, and you're never going to be able to compete with them because they're already big and they're already established. But, you know, finding four optometrists to share space with and sharing skill sets gave me a step up instead of hanging a shingle and waiting for a patient to show up. You know, I think.
Right. Well, I think it's brilliant too, especially given our background. I'm okay never doing contact lenses or refraction or spectacles ever again. I'm okay with that.
Well, you know, for me, what was great was it was a time when early Restasis came out a long time ago. And I really established my niche by treating, believe it or not, dry eye back in the early 2000s.
Before it was cool, because now it's all over the podium.
Right. But, you know, it was definitely not cool. But what it did was it created a connection between me and the optometrist where I was dealing with all of their unhappy contact lens patients, giving them back happy contact lens patients. Their patients were happy. My practice was growing. So I think, you know, when you're looking at how to establish yourself in a community that may be already a crowded community, it's finding your niche, finding something that everyone needs but doesn't already do. That doesn't mean you can't do what they're doing. It means, you know, finding the one thing that somebody needs and being right, that person. And, you know, the other thing I think it's really, really, really important that nobody does when you're opening your own practice is to be the easy button. So go to the ER, go to all the urgent cares, you know, go to the primary care docs, go to, you know, the endocrinologist and be the easy button. Say, you can call me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all the optometrists in the community, and I will never say no to you. And that's what I did. And even today, those same primary care doctors and the urgent cares still know they can call me and I'm never going to say no. And it's a rule. I mean, I don't care if I have to stay late, but that's really what you do for a community to fit in when you feel like maybe there's no room, is that nobody else wants to see those patients. Nobody else wants to see that red eye from the urgent care. But when you're starting out, you're like, sure, send them over. And that red eye patient now has five family members that know that you saw this patient on Friday night at 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And the OD knows that they can send you that corneal ulcer at 5:30 on Friday night, you know? So I think those are the things you got to think out of the box when in this type of era. I think the other really important thing is you don't need all the bells and whistles when you first open. You just need the essential ones. You have to make keep that list of what is exactly the bare minimum that I need. I'll be a little uncomfortable. And then when, you know, I had one, colleague that said to me, you know, when to grow, it's kind of like putting a belt around a balloon, and that balloon gets tighter and tighter as you pull that belt. And just before the balloon's about to pop, you let it out a notch. Mm-hmm. And that's when you know that it's time to grow or add something, maybe another person. But you have to be uncomfortable. Otherwise your overhead might be too high. For what you're able to bring in.
A delicate balance.
Yeah.
Well, I love the idea of be that easy button. Bam, easy, done. I did the same thing. When I first started off in practice, I told any primary care doctor, any urgent care, if I'm in the office, I'll see them today. Just send them over. I'll see them today, no matter what. If it's my lunch, I'll see them. If it's the end of the day after work, I'll see them. Just send them over. I'll see them today.
Yep. It and goes a long way.
Right, because you imagine you're the primary care doctor in the urgent care, and you get another ophthalmology patient, some red eyes, some not. Who knows what it is? You send that over, just done. And they're so happy.
I mean, they have to be comfortable pounding the pavement. And I think a lot of young doctors are not.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of young doctors think that people will come because they're there. But sometimes you have to go when you don't have a lot of patients and go visit people, introduce right. yourself, you know, go speak at a church or do something. If you're not busy, don't just sit. There. Go. Yeah, go out and pavement. Find people.
Absolutely. You know? Hit the pay. Absolutely. The other one I thought was a fantastic pearl that I would always tell my young residents is when the urgent care doctor sends this patient to our clinic for, quote, rule out glaucoma because they have a red eye, you tell that patient, I'm glad Dr. Jones in the ER sent you over for this. Luckily, it's just some allergic conjunctivitis and you don't have glaucoma, but it could have been glaucoma. So that's a fantastic doctor there in the ER.
So that's what you're talking about is finesse. And that right. is such an important skill set because many times that happens in different settings. It might be an optometrist that sends them over or, like you said, the ER. And, you know, finesse with patients is a skill set that's so, so important to learn. Such an important right. skill.
Right. And then I always look at the opposite side, too. I mean, if I don't know ER stuff. I don't know actual emergencies. I don't know how to do your advanced cardiac life support, but the ER doctor does. So if the ER doctor doesn't know ophthalmology, it's okay. You can even spell ophthalmology wrong. I don't mind. Just send the patient over. I'll take care of the patient.
That's right. That's right. You and I grew up at the same time.
Right.
And hopefully, people are still, I think young ophthalmologists are still learning that too.
Right. No, I know these are super important lessons there. I mean, because those little things, like I'd also remember too, you see a patient coming into your clinic, referred in because he's got the metallic foreign body in the cornea working on his car. Okay. You take that out, you fix them up, make them more happy. Because you remember that one patient who's very happy has two grandmas and two grandpas. Yes. And baby, yes. That is 8 cataracts.
You know, I think there's 2 other really important points for young ophthalmologists when they're opening their own practice or even joining an existing practice, and they're a specialist, a glaucoma person or a plastics person or a cornea person. There's 2 really important things. One is always return that patient. No matter what the patient says to you, send that patient back to where they came from. Even if the patient says, you know, Dr. Fulner, I really like your practice. I'm very comfortable here. I want to stay here. Learning how to send that patient back with language that gives them confidence in the referring doctor while not saying you don't want to keep them because you don't like them or whatever is an important skill. And the second thing that if you're building your own practice is communication. And I think sending a letter to every single doctor on that patient's list. And now it's easy. You just push a button. It used to be, I'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning with a stack of charts and have to dictate these letters. Now I push a button and all their doctors get it. But you know, communication with their primary care and any referring doctor. So everyone knows where their patient is, you know, and especially for referring doctors, you know, the worst thing is that they disappear into your practice and you don't even know it. It doesn't right. feel good. You know, it's happened to all of us. I mean, I've referred patients out and not only do they never come back, but I don't even know what happened to them. And that's a terrible feeling. And you only get to make that mistake once. And then that doctor is never going to send you again because, you know, they feel like I lost a patient and I don't know what happened to them. So those are 2 really important pearls for people thinking about either opening their practice or just coming out of training into a practice.
So what would you say to a patient in that scenario who, let's say the patient referred to you and you patient loves you now and the patient wants to stay with you. How do you finesse that conversation?
So it's taken years for me to come up with the like really comfortable verbiage on that. I usually say, you know, let's call it Dr. Smith. Dr. Smith and I have a fantastic relationship and I had the opportunity to treat you because Dr. Smith believes that I have skills that he or she doesn't have. And I've taken care of what needed to be taken care of. It might be a cataract, might be a corneal ulcer, might be anything. And I'm going to return you to Dr. Smith, who's going to take fantastic care of you and he and I or she and I are going to communicate. So if there's anything that I need to know in the future or you're having a problem, you're always welcome back. But we have a great communication system and you're always going to be in good hands having both of us in your back pocket. And if that doesn't work, I say, if I took every one of Dr. Smith's patients that came here, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to take care of you.
Oh, I like that.
And then they're usually like, okay, I get that. Because some are pretty persistent.
That's brilliant. I like that. So you're very obviously you finesse it beautifully because you're being straight with the patient, a little bit firm, but also very, very sweet about it. Oh, I'm taking notes here. Young ophthalmologists who are listening, you better be taking some notes. This is fantastic. And then I like the other one of don't let the patient just disappear into your practice. You're right. They want to have at least some feedback of what happened to that
patient. It's happened to me and it's not a good feeling. It's not a good feeling at all. And, you know, you kind of take it personally, even if it's not meant to be personal. It's just a busy practice and they have a scribe and the scribe forgot to push the button.
Right.
You know, forgot to push the button, send Dr. Fulner a letter.
Right.
You know, I think you have to really teach your staff the importance. And, you know, one of the things that is important in having a great practice is having a great staff. And your staff has to be engaged in your values. And I educate my staff on my values. And they know and they emulate that value system. And they know that the importance of our practice succeeding is one of the, there's many things, but one of them is that we communicate with those doctors and all the doctors stay on the same page and that we return patients and they understand that the staff supports that. And they know that clicking those buttons, that scribe knows click, 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 is important for our ongoing success. And they feel part of that success. And I think engaging your staff in your values is critical to not let those things fall through the cracks as we start delegating more and more of what we do to other people.
Yeah, no, for sure. Those are all great points. But I think you're right. We can definitely, it's not too late. You can certainly have a nice private practice. And the big advantage there is, of course, there's nothing better than being your own boss.
Well, you know, I just recently went through the transition. So I had all the experiences. You know, I went in a big practice, a little practice, my own practice. And 2 years ago, I sold to private equity. And, you know, that's just a whole nother transition.
Tell us about that. I'm unfamiliar with that whole aspect because I'm still just working for myself. But how was that transition? How'd you make the decision?
So how I made the decision. So, you know, my very, very closest friend, Dr. Maria Scott, opened her own private equity company with some VC investment now 7 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that. And she was always like, oh, you know, you should be part of this. You should be part of this. And I wasn't mentally prepared for that. I didn't feel a need for it. I was still really happy with what I was doing. And along the way there, I hired another MD, an oculoplastic surgeon, to kind of fill the gap in my aesthetics division. I was really felt like I was torn in too many directions and I couldn't grow both all the different sides of the practice. And it didn't really work out very well. It wasn't a great experience for me at that time. Mm-hmm. And it started me thinking, what am I going to do? You know, I'm older. And what am I going to do with this practice one day? And so I thought, you know, probably it's not a bad idea to consider. And my kids were like, we're not doing that. We're not going into ophthalmology. So, you know, I kind of started thinking I need an exit strategy and no one's going to buy this. No other doctor can afford this. Nobody's going to be able to buy it. And so I started thinking about it and then COVID hit and I was like, okay, now is really bad time to sell my practice. But in 21, I, you know, worked my tail off to make up for 2020 and at the end of 2021 sold the practice and was very grateful that I was able to rebuild things in a year after, you know, kind of the hit everyone took during 2020. And I have to say the first year and a half was really rough because the speed at which we as owners make decisions and the rate at which we think and are able to calculate all of the important things in decision making and put all the people in the right place to make things successful, it's like, you know, getting in a Porsche and slamming the brakes on. Because in a big corporate setting, everything happens at a much slower level. And there's like 48 people that are making that same one decision that you made. That's the hardest thing to get used to, that every 6 month growth, or that, you know, all that fast movement that you're used to. That, and somebody coined it, I think might have been Dick Lindstrom, about being nimble. He, during the COVID shutdown, it's like being nimble is what allows us as owners to be successful and move and change. And when you're part of a big business, that being nimble is not even a word, you know, it's not. That was the hard transition for me. You know, I was really grateful not to do HR anymore. That was like my most favorite thing. Oh, it's snowing. Should we open the practice or not? I don't know. Not my choice anymore. I love that. You know, so there's some really good bonuses to it, you know, that I have an exit strategy. And, you know, there are other things that, you know, it's that whole thing about not being afraid of change and, you know, being able to adapt to change. And now, 2 years into it, I'm much happier with the choice that I made. And, you know, I think, you know, shortly after I sold, they went for their second bite. And so there was a little chaos after that, because then they had new owners again. Mm-hmm. And so I got caught up in a little of that. But now I think, you know, I'm not unhappy with the decision I made. It brings a lot of comfort, and I've worked my way into learning how to communicate the changes that need to happen in a way that corporate ophthalmology hears things, which is different than the way we think. And the information they need to make decisions is different than the way we think. And that's a learning curve. And that's just part of the whole learning. So it's different, but much better now, you know, 2 years in.
Probably another good upside is like stress reduction for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's different stress. You know, it's really different stress, because before, when you were frustrated or you had a problem, you just made the solution, right? Yeah. You just did it. Now you don't really have control over the solutions. And so there's a different kind of stress. But, you know, I do like the fact that I don't have to worry about, you know, the bottom line. You still have to worry about ROI. You're still, you know, making sure that, you know, you can get things for your practice that you think you need. So you still have to go through the exercise of figuring out the return on investment and figuring out where it's going to go and how many people does it take. And I call it the air we breathe. So every time you make a decision in your practice, you need to calculate everything down to the air we breathe. And that includes your time, tech time, how much space, what do you have to displace to put it in there? Or, you know, who do you need to move? Do you need to hire someone? Do you need to build something? And those things are all still there. If you want to have something happen, you know, and you're in a corporate setting, you still have to do all that math and you still have to do all that thinking, but you don't have control over the outcome. So it's a different kind of stress.
Different kind of stress. But yeah, I mean, well, that's the nice thing too. It sounds like it's enabled you to kind of balance a personal family life with work life a little bit better.
Yeah. And
ultimately, I think for all of us, that's the goal.
It's a little different, you know, having PTO now, which you never had before, right? When you're on your own business, you're like, I'm going to go to 7 meetings this year and it's going to be fantastic. And I'm just going to tell my staff to block my schedule. Now it's sort of like, okay, well, how many weeks off do I have? It's just different.
Yeah, of course, a little bit of a balance there. But I think one of the things that I think all of us, even I struggled with at times was, you know, personal life, family life balance with work life.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean,
that's just a tough one, especially. Yeah, I made a career being a you know, consultant and traveling the world in my 30s, and so I just missed out on so much. And
you know, it's interesting that you say that, because Blake Williamson, it might have been a year ago, interviewed on his podcast Daryl White, me, and Maria Scott, and he was asking us, because the three of us all made choices in our early careers not to spend too much time on the road. All three of us chose family. And then as our children got older, we were like, okay, now we're going to go out and, you know, kind of be on the road, be on the podium, be super busy, you know, outside of our practices. And, you know, it is a decision. And I have a lot of women ophthalmologists ask me, you know, I feel overwhelmed now. Like, what do I do? My kids are growing up and I'm all of these things, you know, how do you say no? How do you say no and feel like you're not going to become inconsequential. Like they're going to pass over right. you, and somebody else is going to be more important, and yeah, they're going to stop asking yeah. you if you say no. And I think, you know, Maria Scott said something to me that has been one of the most valuable things to me. And she said, the only people who are going to care about you when you are old or you die is your family. Nobody else is going to care. Right. And she said, the second thing is you're going to always make more money in your practice than you will.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Outside your practice. For and sure. those two things are super important, right? Because they speak for both sides of things. Like, you know, as consultants, we make money doing whatever it is we're doing, but we're definitely going to make more money if you're sitting in your exam lane, seeing cataract evaluations or refractive surgery right. or whatever, you're in the OR. And the thing is about your family is you really can't get any of that back. You cannot. Nope. Yeah. And they grow so fast. Like my husband and I were like, oh my God, I can't believe how old our daughter is and our son, you know, what happened? Mm. How did, like, that must mean we're really old now. And you know, I don't have any regrets about flipping the curve for me, you know, and investing in my practice early and in my family early. It was the decision right. I made as a resident. And you know, now I'm kind of, it's a lot more fun for me. It's a lot less pressure from a personal perspective. And my husband comes with me because we don't have kids at home.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm the same way. I did a ton of traveling and made the mistake of being away from kids when they were younger. And the one wake-up call for me was I've told the story before, but I got a letter in the mail from one of the hotel chains that said, hey, congratulations on being diamond status. And I was like, cool. And then it says, because you stayed in our hotel 63 nights last year. And I was like, what? A yeah. sixth of the year? So then I actually did, when my kids were basically until they graduated high school, from like, let's say, sixth grade till 12th grade, I did zero meetings. Anytime there was a meeting, we did a family vacation instead.
You know, that's the thing. That's another thing. Maria Scott's so wise. I mean, she's retired now, which is a huge loss. But she said, if I'm going to take time off from work, I'd rather be on vacation with my family.
Smart.
Right?
Smart. Yeah, for
big
sure.
time. Big time. And it's really changed my approach. You know, I do go to meetings. I don't go to nearly as many as I used to. And that's because, you know, my kids are getting older. They're going to have the families of their own. They're not going to mm-hmm. be spending vacation with me. You know, they're not going to want to go on trips, and they're going to have their own families.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's a really important thing. I think there's a lot of pressure on young ophthalmologists right now to be out there and be famous right out of the gate, you know, be sought after, be a KOL, mm-hmm. be on the podium, write lots of things, be members of all these secret societies. And it's a lot of pressure. And I tell them, you know, the trade-off is always going to be your family and your personal life. There, right. And if you're afraid that you won't be relevant anymore, is that loss of immediate relevance as important as yourself, your mental health, and your family? If running in that, you know, mouse in a wheel is more important, than keep going. But there's a burnout, right? There's a burnout yeah, to that. And then there's sure. this whole thing that you miss in between. And, you know, I'm a testament to say that you don't have to be fresh out of training to be relevant, that mm-hmm. you can make that decision to spend time with your family and for yourself, and then decide when is the right time for yep. you to get out there and share your knowledge and your skills and your enthusiasm. The world's always waiting.
Yep. Ophthalmology will always be here. You can take time off a year or two, like me, 6, 7, 8 years off, and do only family stuff. And now then when you're an empty nester and your kids are off at university, or me now, like you, my kids, gosh, probably the next 5 to 8 years are going to be married and have their own families. Now's the time. Like, now I've got plenty of time to travel, and I got plenty of time to do the meetings. And yeah. ophthalmology is still here. And yes, I lost many opportunities, but I gained so much more by having that incredible family time.
And you know, industry always, if you're good,
you're
and
good.
You speak well, you're still going to be good and speak well later, and they still want to mm-hmm. hear from you, and they still value your knowledge right. and anything you want to give to them. They're still willing to have use and promote. So I don't think it's like a one time, you know, trip around the earth. I think you have plenty of time to to become relevant and then maybe step away and step back or not step into it until later. I think it's just a personal decision. Everyone has to make, but I think there's a lot of pressure on these young people. I because of social media and all of this exposure that they get that we didn't have when we were starting out. I think that comes with a lot of pressure and, you know, they talk about it and they talk to me about it and ask my advice, you know, and I think you see some of those younger ophthalmologists stepping away from some of that pressure and reprioritizing. And I've seen quite a few do it and I'm really proud of them finding new balance. Yeah,
that's important, especially, you know, for a lot of us, there's a narrow window where you can actually first even have kids. And we've all delayed that so many years just because of our path in doing medicine, basically give up our 20s.
And absolutely. So I gave up my 30s.
Right. It's a long, long trek there.
It is. But,
so then obviously the future is still certainly very bright for young ophthalmologists in the U.S. I think the nice part is we still only train 500-ish ophthalmologists a year, probably not enough to make up for the ones who are even retiring.
I think they're retiring at a higher rate now than I can remember. Like some of the greats have retired in this past year. Some of the really, you know, foundations of ophthalmology. It's and a lot have moved into industry. You know, I think that's like the new path that's not new, but more popular path.
Right. Just kind of shifting gears a little bit. But I think it's a fantastic time to be a young ophthalmologist. I certainly encourage anyone, like, you know, maybe one of my kids will follow my lead, but maybe they won't, but that's okay too.
It's been a great career for me. It's perfect for my personality. You know, I don't like to sit very often and I love to work with my hands. You know, as a molecular biologist, you're always doing things with your hands and I like change. Like I love change. I never like things the same. I love surprises. I love change. I love innovation. I love technology. I love treating patients of all different ages. I love that in ophthalmology, you can't forget everything else you know about medicine. You still have to remember internal medicine and infectious disease and oncology and pharmacology. And you still need to know all those things. You don't have to do them every day. You just have to know them, you know? And I love that, you know, I feel still really well-rounded medically. But, you know, I get to do what I like and that's work with my hands and I don't have to sit very long. In any one given time, which is good for me, which is why I didn't become a neurosurgeon, because that's what I always thought I would do is be a neurosurgeon.
Oh, wow. That's like, you gotta be married to the hospital to do that, right?
Right. Well, it's just one of the choices I made. I met one female neurosurgeon down at, my cousin, was a neuro-ophthalmologist at Bascom Palmer. And, he introduced me to a female neurosurgeon when I was down there doing a rotation as, a med student. And she was like, if you want to have a family, if you want to preserve your marriage, you know, she's like, if you want to not fight for your position in the world, then, you know, don't do this. Cause she's, you know, so as a woman, she was constantly fighting for her validity as a neurosurgeon and she couldn't have a family. And she was just, like you said, married to the hospital. And I'm like, as much as I love the brain and studying the brain, I don't think that's what I want for my life.
Yeah. It's okay to put yourself and your family and your personal interests and your mental and physical health first.
You only have one life. You can't get to the end of it and say shoulda, woulda, coulda. I mean, it's the worst thing you can feel. You got to do everything you feel like you want to do in life. And then you're satisfied, you know, that you didn't miss anything that was important to you.
Wow, such great words of wisdom. This podcast has been so much fun. There are so many great pearls in this. Like, I need to distribute this specifically to all the young residents who are going through their training. Like, you need to learn this now, hear this now, because the pearls here took me like a decade or two to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, I think I shot from the hip a lot throughout my career. Right. You know, I still do sometimes when I'm looking at your videos before I go in the OR, I'm still shooting from the hip, but, yeah, I mean, I do think that, recognizing who you are and what you enjoy most it has to be the top priority, you know, for your personal life and your career.
Absolutely. Wow. Well, let me tell you, thank you again for doing this podcast. I really enjoyed our conversation. I was smiling the whole time. Well, I relate
to
you.
It's so much fun. I love talking to you. I love talking to you on the computer and live. It's always a joy.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Lisa. And I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new podcast every single week. It's on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, YouTube, anywhere you find your podcast. Also, we got the cataractcoach.com website with the full curriculum series. We got a whole series about learning phaco power modulations and fluidics. And we even have a free Cataract Coach PDF book, all free, all available on cataractcoach.com. And so until next week, I will catch you later.